gentleman. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just...
Well, a very hearty welcome. You've tuned into a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And that song that we hear, Think for Yourself, was written by George Harab. And that's a clue to who's going to be our guest tonight.
Was it with a candlestick in the library?
With a what now?
A candlestick in the library. You said it's a clue.
A clue. Okay. Well, that goes way, way back.
All right.
You're going to be quick. You're going to probably be too quick for me tonight. But at any rate, welcome to the show. And we love to interact with the folks and get questions and comments about our show, feedback. Maybe you could start out
sure.
by telling them, welcoming them to the show, the
yeah.
other part of our show, which is how they can get in touch with us.
Absolutely. We love to hear from our listeners. In fact, many, many of our show topics have actually come from listeners like yourself. So we encourage you guys to give us feedback, ask questions, send us links. You can find us, you know, if you're one of those Facebooker people, you can find us there, Thinking Clearly Radio Show. Just put in Thinking Clearly Radio, it'll come up. And Bob and I are real people. We do check those messages and we love to hear from you. So please give us a like and let us know what you think.
And we've been co-hosting this show for actually 30 months. Okay, that's 2.5 years.
Wow.
Julia Mint and Bob Fraley co-hosting this show together. And
then we had an experimental phase before that. But
well, yeah, we experimented with different versions. We had a show called Hot Topics for a short amount of time
mm-hmm.
in which we kind of previewed the whole idea of critical thinking and would it work on radio.
Yeah, but thinking clearly, I'm not feeling a little too awfully well today, so my words are, I'm stumbling on my tongue. But Thinking Clearly is also a podcast as well as a one-hour radio show on KMUD every first Thursday. So if you missed the previous 29 shows, you're in luck. Just open up your podcast app and add a new feed, search a new feed, however you do that in your particular app. In mine, I just say add feed. I type in Thinking Clearly and it pops right up and I get to subscribe. They're all there. You can listen to us.
And if you want to go the old-fashioned way, if you're an email person and you want to be kind of old school, you can go to thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's where our webpage is, and you can see all of the information about the older archive shows. So, great. Give us a buzz. Give us an email.
Smoke signals.
Get on social media on our Facebook page and make a comment. And we're going to get right to the guest because in some ways, the topic of this edition, I usually introduce the topic. Well, the topic of this edition on Thinking Clearly is our guest himself because George Harab, who wrote that song that we use, and he so generously gave us permission to use as our intro and outro song on this program. He's so eclectic that it makes him essentially uncategorizable. And he wrote and performed the song Think for Yourself that we use at the beginning and end of our show. And he's a musician, a songwriter, a record producer. His main gig musically is playing drums for a Philadelphia area band called the Philadelphia Funk Authority. But it's his podcast called the Geologic Podcast, which has nothing to do with rocks, that gives a clue as to why he's our guest on this New Year's edition of Thinking Clearly. If you put geo from George together with the word logic, then the clue begins to take shape because some of George's other passions are skepticism and promotion of science, humanism, and critical thinking. So, George Harab, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
Am I the ninth caller? Do I get the Shaolin Acrobat tickets? Am I the ninth caller? Oh, I so hope I'm the ninth caller. Oh, guys, I'm so excited. Bob, hey, Julia. Oh, my gosh. Hi, Happy New Year. Happy random New Year.
Happy New Year. Why is it random?
Well, Julia said, you know, it's the random calendar flip, the odometer flipping over, which really, if you think about it, is completely just arbitrarily decided upon. And I love the arbitrary nature of, oh, now we're celebrating. Today, why not? Today. Okay, sure. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, guys.
All right. Well, George, I do want to remind our listeners that we're going to open the phone lines. But before we really start, I'd like to play just a little bit of another song, another of your songs called Skeptic, about which they say on the Skeptic Society webpage, which is at skeptic.com, they say, quote, if skepticism had an anthem, this may well be it.
You can't believe what a skeptic I am. I can't believe you believe in that man. We disagree, but I still give a damn. Your guru assures if you follow his regimen, you will become a most excellent specimen. The power to live on and on for all days is right at your fingertips if someone pays. He says that his aura will keep you alive for three easy installments of $10.95. The device he uses sucks out the bad juices and leaves no bad bruises. It simply deduces the proper percentage of X in your brain. This miracle cure leaves no permanent pain. And still, you can't believe what a skeptic I am.
Oh, I love that. And that's on your album Vitriol, right?
Correct. Yes.
Well, on this show, we've introduced our listeners to the nuts and bolts of critical thinking and related topics, but we've only very seldom used the word skeptic. So let's start out with asking you how you define skepticism and what's your take on skepticism as it relates to critical thinking.
It's so interesting because that word can have such baggage associated with it. And I think in recent years, it's gotten better. When I first started getting involved in the skeptical community, I think it really had a connotation almost equivalent with cynicism, skepticism and cynicism, and this idea of no, nothing's true or nothing can be really known. And I think through the diligent work of people within the skeptic community, it's gotten to the point where it's seen as skepticism is a tool. It is not a belief. It is not an ism, even though it has the ISM in it. It's not something that you look at or believe in, but it's something that you use. And if you approach it that way, that you take a skeptical nature to any kind of claim that's made, from the most mundane to the most important of claims that could be made in your life, if you use your skeptical toolbox to analyze that claim, I think, and most people in the skeptical community think, that your life will be a safer, smarter, saner, and better one. So it's this question of just questioning things and relying on evidence-based proof to have a claim be true or not. It's that simple. It's a tool that just basically makes you take a second and go, what? Like, how does that work? Like what? Again, from the most simplest of things of, you know, is this the best parking space to, you know, should I be giving large sums of money to a church?
Your description then sounds a whole lot like our description of critical thinking.
Absolutely. I mean, I think they are one and the same. To my estimation and to the use of those two terms, I think they're completely interchangeable. One is just, just has a snaz to it, I think, which I kind of like.
Mm-hmm. So some people might think of skepticism, this is the way I've heard it framed before, that skepticism is an attitude and critical thinking is the toolbox. But you're thinking of them as almost interchangeable.
I think they're synonymous. Yeah, I think you're dealing in theoreticals on some level where we're just dealing with a random assigning of language and linguistic properties to a treatment or to a process. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of start crawling up your own sphincter if you start thinking about it too much. But in essence, to me, to remove the sort of taint of cynicism and the taint of denialism. That's mm-hmm. where skepticism, I think, has to really separate itself, where if you do cross over into being a denialist, where you are ignoring mountains of evidence because you have a predisposed notion that makes you, that you are clinging to for whatever reason, for a political reason, for a personal reason, for a cultural reason, you aren't being skeptical about that thing. You are being a denialist. And that, to me, is, that's the big differentiation, and that, that I always try to sort of express to people who ask me what skepticism is about. It's just about thinking clearly, thinking critically. I think one of the best descriptions of sort of skepticism was presented to me by a gentleman named Tim Farley. He has a wonderful website called What's the Harm, where he talks about people who bring up this idea of, you know, oh, what's the harm of acupuncture? What's the harm of any kind of woo process? And he actually sort of shows what the harm can be financially, emotionally, or whatever on his website. But he talked about skepticism being the intermingling of science education and consumer protection. So it's that, it's that the commingling of those two things. It's sort of, if you think of that Venn diagram where you have science education, how does the world work? How do processes work? And then consumer protection. What should I be spending my time, my interest, my money on? Where those two cross over right in the middle, you could call that critical thinking, or you could call that skepticism. I tend to call it sort of a combination of both. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that makes a really good point, in that a skeptic isn't, you know, going out of their way to question whether or not the sun's going to come up tomorrow, because, you know, there's a lot of evidence around that.
Correct.
Yeah, but however, I do think it's important to, you brought up sort of that moral imperative of skepticism, why Houdini, you know, for instance, was very critical of seances and whatnot, because they do, he saw the harm that it caused to his family members.
Sure. I mean, I think the amazing thing about Houdini was, as he stood on stage before he was started sort of debunking these seances, he realized how relatively easy it was to fool people. And he started feeling terrible because he was fooling people, not just for entertainment's sake, but because he was adding this emotional aspect of a deceased relative, a loved one. All of a sudden, he started feeling guilty that, oh my gosh, I am manipulating these people, and they will pretty much do anything I want them to do to have a glint of information about you know, a mother that passed away, or a husband, or a father, or a child, or whatever. And that's when I identify with that as well, that I have the most sort of ire and the most anger and the most vitriol is usually directed towards someone who takes advantage of an emotionally sensitive person who is looking for some kind of answer, and then manipulates it through parlor tricks and very, very basic and simple magic, and then takes advantage of that person's wanting to experience something, quote, supernatural, or wanting to experience communication. So Houdini, to his credit, you know, sort of thought, was on stage and just started feeling really creeped out about it, because he thought, oh my gosh, like, this is just a game. This is a trick. This is something I could teach to people. And boy, they have completely fallen for it. And you could really take advantage of it, and people are taking advantage of it. And it's awful, this sort of the grief vampires that crawl out of the woodwork and then take advantage of people that, you know, have lost loved ones, or have children that are missing, or you know, horrible circumstances that should never be taken advantage of for a financial gain. And people do it. And it's just, that to me is the most disgusting kind of behavior.
Yeah, that makes sense. Earlier, you said that skepticism is not a worldview in and of itself. It's a tool. That kind of leads me to wonder, what is your worldview?
Like, philosophically, or like, I mean, you know, there's an empirical nature to the universe that we're trying to figure out piece by piece. You know, I am not one who believes in any kind of supernatural anything. I think any process that may appear supernatural or not understood is just that. It's just not understood at this point. There is an incredible amount of human perception that can be manipulated, misremembered, twisted and warped around itself in so many ways that can be by some people taken advantage of, or that can appear to be sort of supernatural. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't believe in spirituality. I like the idea that we are animated bags of meat. I like that. I think it's way more interesting and way more unique and special to think that what's going on in our brains is this incredibly complex and wholeheartedly dumb luck amount of chemical reactions that lets us, you know, decide what kind of ties we want to wear. I mean, that to me is such a magnificent and mind-numbing set of circumstances that have to occur for a creature like me to sit and want to watch tidying up on Netflix. But it's pure chemicals that are just doing their thing. That to me is way more interesting than some heavenly being poofing things into existence just because they feel like it. And it also it makes every nanosecond of existence that much more valuable when you realize, like, this is all we got. This is it. Like, this is all that we have. And it's hard to remember that sometimes. But that's what reinforces my sense of awe, my sense of amazement, my sense of value is like, boy, each and every living thing has just won the absolute most odds against lottery that you could possibly ever calculate. And we've each won it. And it doesn't always feel like that, but it helps sometimes in the darkest of moments to think like, wow, I shouldn't. Not only should it not exist, but even if I were to exist, the fact that my brain can work the way it does, as poorly as it does, is just astoundingly interesting. And we're learning more and more and more about all those processes. And see, you ask me a simple question, you get a pageant. So that's kind of where
asking what your worldview is not a simple question.
No, it's not at all.
And you've done an excellent job clarifying that. And it ties in your interest in science as a means of testing that reality that's out there. And what you just said about the precious and value of human existence ties in humanism into that. So it's kind of a naturalistic, scientific, humanistic worldview.
I was just about to go there, Bob, because we have visited humanism before, and I was just recently listening to your Geologic podcast episode number 591, and I really enjoyed I don't believe in Christmas, because I have to say that my personal worldview is very much aligned with that song, and that maybe you could explain a little bit about the heart of that.
Sure. The essence of that song is, look, I live in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. So it's like literally they call it the Christmas city. So I lived here 25 years. I went to college here. So if you count that, it's almost 30 years I've been living in this town. And the first Christmas where I walked around town and sort of saw the efforts of the city to make itself as Christmified as possible, I was just shocked at how beautiful it was, how just lovely and peaceful and community-based and just lovely. It was just a lovely walk around town. This is, again, almost 30 years ago, and I remember some upperclassmen kind of saying, you'll be sick of it in 2 years. You'll be done with it. And here I am 30 years later, and I still – at the holidays, walk around town and just love it. I love the Christmas trees. I love the lights. I love the carols. And a couple of years back, I wrote this song of I have zero belief, zero in the reason for the season. But during the holidays, we tend to be nicer to each other. We tend to buy gifts for each other. And if the reason that we're being nicer and the reason that we're buying gifts for each other is not the most solid reason, there's worse things to be happy about. So the point of that song is, I don't believe in Christmas, but I love it anyway. I have a Christmas tree. I'm looking at it right now. I have my Christmas tree that I put up every year that I just love to do. I got the candles out. I like to buy gifts. I like to get gifts. And it's just, why not celebrate? Why not remove a little bit of that cynicism that sometimes we're labeled with in terms of being critical thinkers or being scientifically minded, and just enjoy the season and be able to say, you know what? If I'm at the mall and someone's going to hold the door for me because they have the Christmas spirit in their heart or in their head, who am I to say, humbug? You know, that's the point of that song.
Yeah, you can be inspired by the story. and the sentiment of the season without buying into the whole what you might consider mythology.
Sure.
So you're getting into some of your history here. I was taking that walk around Bethlehem with you as you were describing it. Can you trace back some of the origins of your interest in skepticism and science and also your current motivations to stay with that?
Yeah, I was very fortunate in that my dad was very scientifically based. And he loved to explain stuff to me, and I loved to ask him questions as a very young person. That combined with being a raised Ukrainian Catholic, so being in church on Sundays and being really confused by everything and sort of really eyebrows aflutter in questioning of like, this doesn't really make sense, or having a religion class on a Saturday at my Ukrainian school that I used to go to, and being able to stump the priest with a question where he would sort of in a cliched way say, yeah, you know, we're not supposed to know some things. And I would think, you know, I'm 8 years old and I am stumping 2,000 years of philosophy. Like, how is that possible? So the combination of sort of having the religious upbringing on one level, and then on the other side of the coin, being a very critically minded, scientifically based evidence gatherer, those two sort of commingled in the best way, where I could see the reason for both sides in terms of the appeal to the human. So that's where it kind of all started. I remember praying once, that I've told this story a bunch, but I think it really started where I was praying for it not to rain, because there was some kind of a baseball game or something I was going to go to. And I was praying to God. I think I was 7 or 8 years old, praying to God, thinking like, gosh, I really don't want it to rain tomorrow. And for some reason I thought, I wonder if there's a kid somewhere else who really wants it to rain, who's praying to God right now. And he might be just as nice as me. He might be just as deserving of whatever. And like, one of us is getting screwed. Like, one of us is getting screwed. And how does that sky guy justify? This is the stuff I thought about in bed at 8 years old. So that kind of was the foundation of it all. I was an altar boy, so I got to see kind of some of the hypocrisy that's involved over there. That was interesting. Counting the money, you know, we had to count what came in. That was very eye-opening as a 12, 13-year-old kid. And then just getting into school and starting to study music and appreciating kind of in the same way that there is a majesty, like I just talked about, to one's brain chemistry, even though it's just chemistry. There is a majesty to sort of the mathematics of music. And even though it's just numbers, in essence, you can have this incredibly beautiful musical experience, beautiful emotional experience. I love the duality of that. And that started me exploring. And then I found a book once I graduated college called Why People Believe Weird Things. And that's where I first saw the term skeptic.
Michael Shermer,
and that's it. And that kind of set me off. And I thought, okay. Oh, all right. This thing where I am is questioning and wondering what this is and kind of not being sure. There's a name for it. And there's actually a bunch of really interesting people that are writing books about this. And that's kind of where it started. And then it was never a plan to write music that was going to be embraced by the skeptical community or the science-based community. It was never a plan to do anything like that. I just wanted to write music that I thought was interesting and about topics that I found interesting. And about 60% of the topics that I find interesting tend to be kind of science-based or questioning or humor-based or whatever. And then I started a podcast because my best friend is visually impaired, and he was on podcasts 12, 13, 14 years ago, one of the first guys to listen to podcasts and introduce them to me. And I started one basically just to make a show for him. And somehow the skeptical community found me, and it's just been a roller coaster ride ever since.
It's amazing. So you answered part of the question of your current motivation, because you've kind of integrated skepticism, being part of the skeptical community, into your music and your other interests. And so that in itself is kind of motivating. It keeps us motivated when we do that. But I'm just wondering, in terms of motivation, how this last 5 or 6 years of entering into the post-truth era, fake news, all the polarity and tribalism that's going on politically. Has that accelerated your motivation at all?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's accelerated it, as maybe more intensified it. I always felt, or always have thought, that it's been a pretty fast paced, and it's like being on a sinking ship, and you keep finding holes, and you sort of patch this hole over here, and then let go, and there's another hole over, and I got to patch this hole over here, and so you end up doing like a Lucy Ricardo routine, where you're trying to grab the chocolates off the conveyor as fast as you can. I think, yeah, of late this post truth thing has intensified the need to be diligent and the need to understand. This is what's been interesting, I think, in the last couple of years with the skeptic movement, or at least my experience in it. It's been less about telling people they're wrong and more about understanding why people are wrong. And I think that's been a very important pivot.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, yeah.
Because that's a nuance.
Yeah, it is a nuance, and I think it's a very important one, and it's a much more embracing and inclusive one. Because it's one thing to have someone espouse whatever their belief may be. And it's one thing to say, you're wrong, you're an idiot. Only a moron would believe that, which could be completely true. However, you're never going to convince that person or that person's friends or the friends of the friends of that person that maybe what they're believing should be altered or should be changed if it's that antagonistic of like, you're an idiot for believing that. If we can take a second and think, why does that person believe that thing? What are the processes that are involved in making that person believe that outlandish claim, that ridiculous claim? What is it taking the place of? What is the process that's led them to that belief? And you then deal with those underlying processes and not the belief itself, you have the opportunity to have a much larger influence in terms of helping people think clearly. You know, you can, like, there's the thing of, okay, someone has a crazy belief. How do you approach that? Well, connect with them on something else that they think is crazy. Because invariably, you know, it amazes me the bifurcation of the mind. And this is, all of us are guilty of this. Someone can be an acupuncturist. You know, they can practice acupuncture. And they look at Reiki therapy and they go, that's crazy. Reiki's crazy. You're not even touching the person. That's insane. As opposed to acupuncture, which makes a whole bunch of sense because blah, 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 blah. If you can connect with that person and go, yeah, isn't Reiki really weird? Because like, what's going on with the Reiki process, blah, 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 blah. And then slowly you can almost infect their critical thinking process that might then start applying to their own stuff.
Yeah.
That's the main difference. And that's, like I said, that's been the main pivot in the last decade, I think, where skeptics were very, very, and there's still a number of these, but I think the younger generations that are coming into this movement that might not even be aware they are in the movement, there's a much larger desire to understand why people believe weird things. Like the very first book that I read that got me involved in this, why people believe weird things, not people believe weird things and they're morons. Like, I would never have bought that book. You know, well, maybe at 19 I would have bought that book, but at 47, that doesn't interest me. I don't want to castigate people. I don't want to make fun of people for believing strange things. There, of course, are limits, and there are insane, outlandish beliefs or people that take advantage of others, like we said previously. But for the most part, I want to understand why you vote that way. I want to understand why you believe that way. I want to understand why you think that thing is true and this other thing isn't. Because if we can agree on the thing that isn't, maybe then we can agree on the thing that is.
Yeah. Well, on this podcast, we're working towards developing an idea called intellectual empathy. Kind of a correlate of steel manning, to attempt to understand that other person's argument and say it back to them in its strongest form. And then finding common ground and points of that we do disagree with. And the other thing, it sounds to me like part of your process is that same thing that earns you some appreciation for asking good questions of the priest, because good questions will get to the people very quickly. It will get the person thinking at a different level. So that's all great stuff. Let's shift gears a little bit here. You've been a I know a frequent guest because I've heard you on the Novella Brothers podcast, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Steve Novella has been a guest on Thinking Clearly here. He was talking about science-based policies. So I was wondering.
He just goes on and on, doesn't he? He blathers on and on. It's just
very
talk about a pageant.
Yeah, oh very God. Succinctly blather. I wish I could blather that succinctly.
Seriously, but, I know. Seriously, yeah,
I know.
Amazing.
You're being facetious, but so he has a new book out called "The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe." How do you know what's really real in a world of increasingly full of fake? And it's a wonderful book, I think. I'm just wondering, have you read the book? What do you think of it? What's your opinion?
Bob, I had a galley copy, Bob. So I had one of the very first copies. So okay. I don't want to just, you know, I'm sure you read it and you enjoyed it. But yeah, I had about 6 months ago, I had a galley copy. So, you know, I'm on KMUD.
You're not bragging about that, are you?
Yeah, I'm not bragging about it, no. I think it's amazing. I think what Steve and everyone at the Skeptic's Guide has done with this book is quite a feat. What I love about it is that, number one, it's a resource so that you can read it cover to cover in order, and it has a wonderful narrative voice to it. Steve's voice comes across on every page, which is, I think, the most valuable thing about it, in that it is very, it's so conversational in the same way that Steve can blather on, but in the most interesting and kind of personable way. You're reading it and you feel like you're having coffee with this person, which is the best kind of writing, I always think, especially when dealing with a subject like this that can get very technical or very sort of specific in terms of its descriptions and the processes that are involved in the various scientific sort of thinking methods. However, you can also just use it as a resource where you literally can go to the index. And if someone is talking to you about, magnet therapy, and you're not totally familiar about, okay, what are the believers of magnet therapy believe, and what does the science say about magnet therapy? You go to that chapter, and you read the 6 or 7 pages of that chapter, and boom, you are going to have a great, great starting place to be able to talk about it, or at least understand what the subject is. And you not only can do that for yourself, but then you can give it to someone else and say, hey, read this chapter on magnet therapy before you spend $80 on that magnet thing. This is a book I really like, and just read it and see what you think. See if this is going to be interesting. So I think it's an incredible achievement. The fact that it's selling as well as it is a testament to the diligence of the Skeptic's Guide folks and how hard they work and how hard they've worked to make it as excellent a book as it is. And I think it's a really, really fantastic thing. And I'm not just saying that because they thank me in the
because
end.
You're not just saying that because you have a galley copy.
Yes, exactly.
I didn't get a galley copy, really, and I agree with everything you said.
See, there we go. So yeah, proof. Two sources. Yeah. No, I love it. And what was so exciting was we were at QED in Manchester back in October, and to see people from Manchester lining up to buy. I mean, they kept selling out. Every place we had a book signing, they would sell out. And it was so just exciting to be across the ocean and people going nuts for this book, just having not even read it yet, just to be excited to hold it in their hands, to see the influence of the SGU. And again, they're going on 13 years of podcasting, and they're among the first to do this kind of thing. And they have done such a consistently good job of staying on point, staying on message, being empathic, being understanding, and just diligent, and never skipping a week, and doing all the interacting with all of the fans, and it's wonderful. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, and it's recommended highly. It's one of the few books that I've ever seen that is still, after it's been out a while, has 4.7 out of 5 stars. That's 90%. Giving it a 5-star rating. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
With
an
great
N of 142. So,
there you go.
You know, I keep watching it going, it's got to fall way below that because,
well,
you know.
I'd like to know more about that rating criteria myself.
I think it's a classic. I think it's going to be one of these things that 10, 20 years from now, it'll still be a resource, much like, you know, Carl Sagan's books. You can go back and you can read them, and they still have a lot of sort of vibrance and significance to them. I think this, even in some ways, because it's so encyclopedic in its nature, and yet it is so approachable and readable, I think it's going to be around for a very, very long time.
I do love their accessibility So in continuing the conversation about skeptics and skepticism, you are heavily connected with the skeptics movement and the community of skeptics, as well as a number of other, skeptically oriented organizations where you, I understand you've emceed at events and things like that. Could you kind of paint a picture for our listeners? What is it like being in that room?
You know, it's funny. There is a little the stock line that I say is when you're at a conference, let's say SciCon, which is the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, or you're at a QED, Question, Explore, Discover in Manchester, or you're at a TAM, the Amazing Meeting, which used to be held in Las Vegas, and you're in a room, you know, full of 1,000 like-minded people. You get that sense sometimes of, oh, you know, are we preaching to the choir? And I always say, you know what? For once, it's kind of nice to be in the choir. You know, we so rarely get to be in the choir that it's a lovely opportunity for like-minded people to get together and be able to talk about stuff, be able to compare notes, be able to compare experiences. To me, the most interesting conversations always occur in what I call like the last 5%. So like if you and I agree about a topic, you know, whatever the subject may be, man is a space exploration. If we agree, yes, funds should be used to explore space. There's no question we should be doing that. And then we get on this debate of, well, should it be manned or should it be robots? Like that to me is a way more interesting conversation than should we or shouldn't we be exploring space? The conversations, the debates, the discussions that happen in that final 5% of difference are so interesting. And those conferences, those 3, 4, 5 days, whatever they tend to be, are just full of those kinds of conversations where you understand there is a baseline of understanding between people. So that if you're going to have a conversation, you don't have to explain what Reiki is. You don't have to explain what cognitive dissonance is. You don't have to explain, you know, for the most part, people that are going to these things already have this general understanding of what we're talking about. And then you just have the most amazing 2 a.m., you know, alcohol-fueled conversations about whatever the conversation may be. And that's the really special part of those conferences. Yes, the lectures are always top-notch and interesting and fascinating, and you invariably learn something. For every half hour you're listening to a speaker, you're learning things. But on top of that, you get these wonderful interactions with people. And there are friends that I have that I only see at these conferences that I consider to be very close friends, even though literally I see them 2 days a year, 2 days every other year. But because you've had those 3 a.m. conversations, it's like being in a foxhole with someone. So you have a real connection. And that's the beauty of those conferences, I think.
Am I to believe that everyone there kind of agrees about the same thing and they're all kind of starting on the same baseline and that there aren't disagreements between people about substantive issues?
No, there are, but I think you know, generally you're not going to be having conversations like you would at the DMV or like at your family's dinner table in terms of contrasts. There are interesting political differences, there are interesting generational differences, there are cultural differences, which is wonderful. And that's the fascinating thing. But no one is saying, you know, Carl Sagan is a fraud. Hmm. You know, no one is saying, science is not worth teaching, or, you know, the Bible is literally true. There are some people that go to those conferences that whose point is to be that person, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the general person that goes to a conference like that is going to have sort of a baseline of understanding and similarity.
They're going to have some common ground by the time they've taken the trouble to go to the travel to where the conference is, paid the money down. They're going to have some common ground there. I guess my question is, because we do have a skeptics webpage organization here, Humboldt Skeptics, which I'm a member of, but I'm not that well connected to
all the other. It's a very informal group.
It's very informal, but I'm not that connected to the larger groups, more well-organized groups. So I don't have a sense. And my question is, do you think that movement is growing? Has it plateaued? What's your sense of that?
It's so difficult to say, because like with any kind of movement or any kind of even that word is just weird, because it's, you know, what are we proposing? What are we, you know, we're saying people should think clearly. like, that shouldn't be a movement. You know what I mean? That should be like, in the same way that, you know, you should eat every day and brush your teeth. There's no like toothbrushing movement. You know what I mean? There's like, to even sort of think of it in those terms is almost disheartening on some level. But it's very hard to quite know what the numbers may be, how they are. And because these types of organizations or these types of movements tend to bifurcate very quickly. So you'll get, you know, it used to be, I mean, not even before the internet, at the early days of the internet, where you would find people of a like mind in there, and you were limited in terms of, there was maybe one or two kind of skeptic conferences you could go to, you know, in 2000, 2002 or something. It was like you had TAM, and that was pretty much it. You know, that's like, oh, skeptic conference. So people went to that. Now there's so many skeptic groups and local gathering things that you don't quite feel the monopoly that would be associated with certain kinds of gatherings or whatever. I think there are so many interesting subgroups of subgroups and just small community groups that get together and that have embraced the broader definition of just thinking critically. That I think it's very hard to kind of put. I mean, people don't like to be labeled to begin with. I don't think there is a centralized skeptic movement in the same way. I don't think there's a centralized Catholic movement or whatever ghost hunting movement. You know, they tend to be sort of pockets of things, and certain people make a little bit more noise than others. But I think there is a healthy amount of understanding. And as with anything that gets a lot of press, people tend to then self-identify afterwards. Like they sort of go as the movement before you know, best-selling books show up on the New York Times bestseller list by Sam Harris or anyone like that. People might not self-identify or might not think about critical thinking. Then that sort of thing kind of blows up for a while and gets very large. And as it passes through, people kind of go, yeah, of course I try to think critically. Yeah, of course. Whereas they wouldn't necessarily assign themselves into the movement, quote unquote.
No, you bring up a good point. And something I think I've seen is some skeptics find more particular specific activities to organize around. Say in San Diego, there was a strong secular movement that you'd find a lot of skeptics in. So it kind of makes sense. Or, you know, how the SGU guys tend to focus on science-based information. I think.
Right.
Did you have something, Bob?
Well, I want to say that we're remind listeners that we're talking to George Horab, musician, skeptic, humanist, science supporter and promoter, a very eclectic person. And we'll continue the conversations, but you feel free to call in and talk to George Horab or make a comment or question about any of the topics that we've been talking about tonight.
It looks like we're getting some callers.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Before,
that's my,
before
my dad, probably.
Yeah. Before I get the signal.
Or my sister.
Yeah. Or both. Before I get the signal from our engineer that we have someone on the line, I do want to make both a statement and ask a question here, because one of the things that I have really realized from doing this show is that being a serious critical thinker is a big commitment. It takes a lot of work to research relevant evidence, to build knowledge base around the issues that we're considering, and then logically reason to best conclusions, especially, here I get on the bandstand, when others are scoring big with their comrades for just echoing the talking points and dominant belief of their tribes. So what makes it important to invest this type of energy and possibly use up social capital in our current climate of uncivil dialogue? We do have a caller, but can you give a short encapsulated answer to that rather huge question?
Sure. True. It's, you know, you have to pick your fights. You have to pick your battles. You know, I mean, there are some times that you need to invest and need to, if you have a relative who is going to go spend a ridiculous amount of money on something which is completely fake and false or is being taken advantage of by someone, then you need to go and get kind of the best information possible into your brain to be able to talk to that relative and influence them as best as you possibly can. It's work. It's work to have the right information, and it's work to keep updating the right information and to be able to sort of be able to have concise arguments. I think the most important thing throughout all of this, throughout all of critical thinking, throughout all of skepticism, is to have empathy and to be able to listen. That is easy. That doesn't require any specific amount of book learning to be able to listen to someone. Because very often the treatments, quote unquote, that tend to be successful, when you boil them down, is just to someone being in the room and listening. It's not the efficacy of needles being put into your forehead. It's not the efficacy of coffee enemas. It's the fact that there is someone in the room and they're listening to that person's problems, and the person with the problem feels like they are being taken seriously and being treated and being helped. I don't know what the percentages are, but a large percentage of those treatments, it is sheerly that fact. And that requires zero learning to be able to be with someone and just say, hey, I'm here. You want to talk? Let's talk. I'll listen. And maybe you can influence them in a positive way, or in a way that's going to get them away from some of the bad thinking. That's what I always recommend. Just empathy, man.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's try it out here. We have our first caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking
Good
Clearly.
Evening.
Good evening, caller.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Do you have a question?
Right. So, hey, George, I have a question for you. You mentioned acupuncture twice during your skeptical talk. And I wonder how many scientific studies you've read about acupuncture, actually, because it seems that it is actually quite effective for many, many people, like maybe a billion Chinese. So maybe they all believe something, but it works for them. So can you explain how you think about that critically then?
Yeah, sure. There's actually a really fascinating study that was done that basically did an acupuncture treatment, but they didn't insert the needles. They only pretended to insert the needles, and the treatment was just as effective as inserting the needles. So,
who was this study by?
You know, I don't have that exact.
Oh, you don't know. You should come up with more specific, you know, information there. I can tell you this. I have had an incredibly bad back for quite a while.
Sure.
And acupuncture actually works really well. Okay. Now, I know you just mentioned, so you actually did something that was really interesting. You confused believing and thinking. Thinking is not believing, and believing is not thinking. Okay.
Say that again.
So there's another thing that you'd like. When you talk about scientific studies, you mentioned that you were from a very Catholic background. You know. So studies are very often done when they're steeped in their own belief, even if it's very subsurface. You know, Western science, for example, like you just mentioned, acupuncture, you know, it's been shown that it doesn't work or that it's fake. No, man, it's not true. So you need to start thinking a little bit more critically about your own belief systems, all right?
Okay, well, to me, the double-blind studies that I have read about, unfortunately, who I can't recall, I mean, specific examples right now, because I was going to be talking about my music, but... you know, what's
that's
curious
why you
is
stay with the music because you know.
That's not fair.
Acupuncture treatments, and they work.
I'm going to go back to where we started in the radio show.
Leave him on.
Well,
cool.
Yeah, we'll come back to it in a minute, but I'm just going to come back to where we were before. You had mentioned a really important point, which is when you want to talk about difference of opinions, simply calling someone an idiot probably isn't the way to have a thoughtful exchange. And I kind of feel it's sort of what happened.
I don't know. If we had more time for this, I think that we would be able to sort of play out this whole idea of finding common ground. So let's go ahead and bring our caller back up and see if he's still there and see if we can get a little closure. Caller, go ahead.
Let's go fuck you, asshole.
Okay, then. That's it.
it's a shame. You know, it's funny. I just have the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe book in my hand, and I just turned to the page that talks about that exact study that I was talking about.
Uh-huh.
Well, in the meantime, I'm humming your Christmas song in my head about how we all can't just be nicer.
I know. And it's, you know, to be honest, I would totally be fine talking to that guy more if he wasn't cursing, but I understand he can't have it on the radio.
No.
But here it is in chapter 27 of the Skeptic's Guide. They talk about that exact study of the Yeah, subjective improvement after differentiated interventions. Yeah, the ones where it's actually a really fascinating thing where they pricked some people and they didn't prick others, and it was just as effective. So, look, I have no doubt that to this gentleman, the acupuncture worked in terms of right. He felt better because probably whatever the symptom was that he was dealing with was not a binary symptom. It was not the kind of symptom where, acupuncture will not grow a limb back. You know, you either have an arm or you don't. That is a binary problem. You are having a heart attack or you are not having a heart attack. The something like acupuncture that deals with pain, you know, general ideas of pain, is a very subjective thing. And look, it worked for this guy. He had back pain, which, again, is incredibly difficult to gauge. There is no, for all of sciences and medicine's advances, it is incredibly difficult to gauge the pain an individual is feeling. It's always set by the individual. There is no pain meter that you can put on a body and say, oh, you are at a 7.5 pain level or whatever it is. It's always, how do you feel? So these treatments work with huge quotes around them in the idea that, yeah, the person feels better. The person feels better. Yeah. But is the underlying principle, does it make sense? Is there any evidence that chi flows through the meridians of the human body? Yeah. Well, there's no evidence of chi or meridians. So,
And going back to the Skeptic's Guide, item number 27 talks about placebo effects.
Well, I was going to say there's some really interesting research now about people who are taking placebos knowing they're placebos and still having positive benefits. Right. I just find that absolutely fascinating. We are down to our last 4 minutes.
We have another caller.
And we have another caller.
Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, caller. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, it was to comment about the acupuncture and the placebo.
Yeah.
I would wonder if from my understanding, you would have needed to experience the acupuncture for the placebo to work. Like if you just lay down on a couch and you never experienced acupuncture and somebody said, I'm doing acupuncture to you, you know, I don't see how that would really have a big effect on you. But if you've gotten acupuncture several times and you're expecting it, then I could see how that would.
Well, it's actually surprising that you could be influenced by, you know, you get a person in a lab coat and you have a table and you have the candles lit and you have the music playing in the background and you have the gong in the corner. That can really affect the overall efficacy of a treatment. So if someone coming in, like you said, not knowing what the process is, and it's like, I guess this is the process. Okay. It might work.
Environment.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's all of it. It's amazing how much you are affected by stuff you don't even realize you're affected by. You know, the wonderful studies that are done where you have a restaurant and everything is identical in the restaurant, except the label of the wine is different in one. In one, it's like a cheap label, and in the other, it's a very expensive-looking label with some fancy French or Italian name on it or whatever. And categorically, people will say they have had a better experience in the restaurant with the more expensive-looking wine, even though the wine was the same and the food was the same and everything was the same. Those influences are so – this goes back to one of the first things we talked about on the show, about how our brains are influenced by so many things that we can't even fathom or realize that influence the way we think, the way we remember, the way we misremember. So it's fascinating how much of that is going on sort of at the same time. So you get a person that walks into an acupuncture clinic that's never been there. They don't know what it's supposed to be. They have a vague idea of, oh, this might be some, you know, Asian ancient art that works for a billion Asian people, which is I would argue with that. But regardless, this is what it is. And I do feel better because I got to be in a room with someone for 45 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm sure you would feel better if that's but you would think you would need to at least think of some kind of prick or something, you know,
not necessarily
people and, you know. I have another question, though, and it was about AI and how you guys feel about artificial intelligence and how that could come into play with skepticism as far as solving riddles or anything like that. And if that would kind of take you know, I know there's a lot of questions there. I was just wondering what you're feeling.
And I'm just going to.
May not be enough time.
I'm going to add me 2 minutes.
We have 90 seconds. Let's talk about AI. Yeah. That's
but,
a great question,
but,
actually.
But that would, be a, that would be a whole other show that we might get into in the future of our future topics. That's a big question. So
question.
I don't know that
question.
We can actually do any justice to it. But I don't want to add, because I know where you were going, caller, saying that it seems like for a placebo to work is that they'd have to kind of have some idea of what the process was. But that's why they actually do in controlled experiments, why they always include a placebo, because there is such a thing as just called experimenter effects, where the attention from the experimenter, no matter what they're doing, and I think that's what George was talking about.
There's a wonderful writer, if I can recommend real quickly, there's a writer named Ben Goldacre. He's an English scientist and journalist, and he's written a number of books. And I saw him do a talk about placebo, and it was amazingly interesting. I don't have any titles in my head right now, but he's written a number of books. If you want to find out how crazy the placebo effect is, mm-hmm. Check out some works by Ben Goldacre. Amazing, amazing writer.
How do you spell that?
Goldacre, I think.
Okay.
I think that's what it is, or Acre.
We'll
yeah,
Google
Ben
that.
Goldacre.
And I always like to mention when Bob likes to talk about the brain and brain chemicals, I like to remind us that our brain is not isolated. It's connected to our nervous system. When we say
right.
things take place in our brain, it's actually not just isolated to that organ. It's taking part in really our whole body. That's just kind of our computer system that.
Well, George, we're really coming upon the top of the hour here, and we
wow.
have to skate on out of here. It goes fast. So I did want to ask you, and I'm not going to have a chance to actually get a response from you, what you have as future plans. Maybe if you have something that you'd like to talk about in terms of where you're headed in the future, what you're doing, you could email it to me, and I'll post it on our Facebook page. And I will post your 2 websites on our Facebook page.
Yeah, Geology Podcast. Podcast.com. Go listen to the show. That's
yes,
what you have to do. Go.
I will yep. do that. And so thank you very much, George Rob. It's been a pleasant, pleasant conversation. And
thank you, Bob. Thank you, Julia. Keep doing what you're doing, all right? I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks
okay.
for your inspiring music.
Yes.
Yay.
You'll hear it again as we leave the air here. And I do want to thank Julia Minton, wonderful co-host who came in even though she wasn't feeling
yes.
well. She lights up the studio. And I want to thank Eric Allen, our fine engineer. And until next time, keep thinking clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People Powered Radio.